You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryan here on LA Talk Radio.
Hello, my name is David Bryan, and this is Curiosity Invited, a podcast inspired by endless curiosity. Tune in for an open-minded conversation about interesting and important things. Hello, my name is David Bryan, and welcome to Curiosity Invited podcast, where today I'll be speaking with professor, researcher, academician, teacher, author, Dr. Gregory Chasson. His recent book, Flawed, Why Perfectionism is a Challenge for Management. Dr. Chasson is the director of behavioral interventions of the Obsessive Compulsive and Related Disorders Clinic in the Department of Psychiatry and Behavioral Neuroscience at the University of Chicago. I'll bet I'm not the first person who said that is a mouthful. So he is widely recognized in this field, and he's written a book that sounds like it's just focused on business, right? Why Perfectionism is a Challenge for Management, but it is clearly rich territory for anyone who suffers from perfectionism, works with people with some sort of perfectionism, manages people with perfectionism, works with groups of all sorts. So I hope you enjoy the conversation. I certainly did. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Curiosity Invited. My name is David Bryan, and today I have the pleasure of speaking with someone I have just met moments ago, Dr. Gregory Chasson, a behavioral scientist, a clinical psychologist, and a professor and writer. And it turns out you've written numerous academic papers, both himself and with others, and has recently published a book called, the full title is Flawed, Why Perfectionism is a Challenge for Management. So let me just ask you, before we dive into what all that means, is there a lot of conversation in the business world about perfectionism, or is this, because I've not seen that, but I wasn't looking, is this a topic that people have spoken about a lot?
No, actually they haven't, which is partly why I wrote the book. So I'm glad you asked that, because part of the reason I wrote the book is to hopefully get some discourse going on perfectionism in the workplace, because I think it's one of those issues that's there, but people don't necessarily realize it. And it is an absolute saboteur of productivity and healthy workplace dynamics. And I think it's one of those aspects that is not well appreciated or understood, but actually explains so much difficulty in the workplace.
And do you think it's, because I was, when I thought, geez, I haven't come across that, and clearly it's there. You know, my background is education. I taught for years, and I started a school, and I taught continuing throughout that. I don't know if anybody was using it technically correctly, you know, but it was not uncommon to find a kid who was, quote, a perfectionist. Uh-huh. And there's that weird territory of, well, when does focus on excellence and trying to dedication to the task, and when does the needle tip into the zone where, uh-oh, we have a problem here? And the one thing that kept coming up, at least in my experience, was, you know, the kids who could never turn it in, because it was never, and mm-hmm. sometimes it was phenomenal work that they couldn't release on time, couldn't release without a threat, right? You know, you're going to lose points, all those things that people say. And sometimes it was terrible. And sometimes it was an impediment to even beginning a task, because mm-hmm. So when Could you sort through this territory for us? When does I want to make sure I get this right, become, mm-hmm. you know, warning, Will Robinson, we've got a real problem here. There's something else going on.
Right. Well, first of all, you did a nice job of articulating some of the main issues you see with perfectionism. Procrastination, in large part, a lot of it is because of perfectionism. And that's not the only cause. There are lots of reasons that you might end up procrastinating, but perfectionism is probably a very common reason where you can't quite get it where you think it needs to be. It can't quite, it doesn't feel just right. You don't feel like it's good enough. And therefore it keeps getting pushed off and pushed off and pushed off.
And so you, in some cases, don't even start.
Yeah. So I call that in the book, in chapter 6, we talk about process paralysis, which is where you try to perfect the approach or the strategy or the process. And it could include things like trying to know the optimal strategy and trying to figure it out, or trying to identify the optimal steps of doing something. And you get so flustered and get so paralyzed trying to do that, that you don't even get started in the first place. Mm. Or you're so anxious about not getting it just right that you just don't even start. It's easier just to dig your head in the sand. And so I do think that a lot of procrastination stems from perfectionism. And so, you know, you say, does this happen in the workplace? And I think the first question you got to ask yourself is, well, do you see procrastination in the workplace? And, you know, if the answer is, how could it not be? Yes. I mean, it's everywhere. But you're absolutely right. I mean, you see this in kids, and this is, you know, I think it goes to show you how soon and early it develops in one's life. And kids, you asked me what separates perfectionism from non-perfectionism. And it's less about where the needle is, like you indicated. And I think there's actually a bit of a qualitative difference in that people with perfectionism are extremely rigid and excessive in their expectations, and rigid in general around their thinking. So they might have excessive expectations about things needing to be a certain way. And then they're also just rigid in general and all or none about the way they think about things. And so the rigid expectations then interact with these excessive expectations to create, a pretty paralyzing experience for people with perfectionism, because they have these unattainable goals and then they can't pivot and shift gears because of their rigid thinking when those goals become futile to achieve. And so it's really the cognitive rigidity and the inflexibility and the excessive expectations that make perfectionism.
Say that again, because everybody should hear that again, including me.
Yeah, so it's the cognitive rigidity, the inability to pivot and to change one's mindset. In fact, we call it set shifting difficulties, mindset shifting, shifting one's perspective. Very narrow and sort of like the Titanic that can't be shifted out of the iceberg.
It takes
iceberg,
a really long time to turn that crater.
And then there's the excessive expectations, right? The idea that the goals are just well beyond what would be normative or other people expect. Like, I have to get 100% on everything, right?
Excessive expectations of their performance.
Yeah, well, we can talk about that, because there's actually multiple types of perfectionism. One is self-oriented, which is about oneself. You hold these expectations of yourself. And then there's other-oriented perfectionism, which is where you project those standards and expectations in a rigid way onto other people. And then there's what's called socially prescribed perfectionism, which is where you have these perfectionistic tendencies, but they are perceived to come from outside of you and from society at large. So you see an image of a beautiful model on a magazine and you think that's how you're supposed to look. That is a socially prescribed perfectionism.
Right. That's the environment that may or may not affect the particular individual, right? Somebody looks at it and goes, well, you know, that's not me, or that's not real. Somebody else looks at it and, you know, they'll never go to the beach again.
Right. But the bottom line is that it's there. It's socially prescribed as meaning beautiful and optimal.
Right.
And the degree to which someone internalizes that is socially prescribed perfectionism.
Because I see.
It really can impact someone's view of themselves. Whereas the person next to you, they may not care. the person, you might sort of internalize that as, oh, that's how I'm supposed to look.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I was wondering also because it's not a big topic at the moment, if anything surfaced, like, do you think that this is a growing issue in the workplace because more and more work, I don't know if that's true, certainly more and more work of a certain kind happens in teams, sort of stridently in teams, you know, people work in teams from no matter where they are. And so it shows up because I could imagine, well, you're the expert, you should tell us. I mean, you could hear me imagine, but I can imagine that sometimes it's the perfectionist is an impediment to things moving on because they can't produce in the timely way. And sometimes I could imagine it shows up because the person is completely intolerant of the crappy stuff done by somebody else, stuff done by somebody else on the team. And it just makes it an unworkable environment. And so.
Yeah. You just articulated two themes of two chapters of my book.
Yeah.
So you're spot on, pretty intuitive. The first one is this idea that perfectionism can cause this tremendous slowing of productivity within teams. It can create an awful bottleneck because in the book, you know, spoiler alert, I liken it to trying to play mini golf, and there's slow golfers in front of you and you have to wait for them to finish. Everything slows down. You can either wait, you could try to fight them and get them to step aside, or you can just skip the hole. But the bottom line is everything comes to a grinding halt while you're waiting for these people.
Right.
Because they're so slow. And you see this in the workplace. And so it absolutely impacts teams. You can imagine how frustrating it can be for managers, leaders, other team members who are trying to do their best and be efficient and get tremendously slowed down by someone like this. It's like being on a one-lane highway with the slow driver who's going 20 miles under the speed limit, and there's no turnoffs, and you're just sort of screaming out the window, right? But, you know, I think
nobody's had that experience.
No, not at all. Everyone listening knows what kind of driver I am. They're like, oh, he's that kind of guy, right?
That's the kind of guy who honks.
Yeah. But the other chapter that you described is sort of the chapter 9, which is, what do you do when this is other oriented and it starts to project onto other people? This idea of what you should expect from other people. And this word should, I use it purposely because there's should statements, there's should this, should that, ought of this, must have. This really intense universal dictate of what people should or should not be doing for other oriented perfectionists. And it gets particularly toxic when it becomes about morals, moralism. Perfectionists tend to have very strong all or none thinking and expectations about morals and scruples. And so if people are not doing what they think is right or wrong, and then they start to project that out on other people and then start to communicate with them, it could come across as pretty self-righteous. And that kind of environment can really be toxic for
people. Yeah, indeed. In any instance, when that shows up in a workplace, you can imagine where that is a problem, right? That team, that group, that whatever, that is a problem. That individual, it is probably a problem. But how big a problem is it in terms of how often does it happen in the work world? Is there any data, you know, any sort of statistics on, hey, this is a lot bigger problem than anybody thought about it? How come we haven't spoken about this?
It's a big enough problem to where not only has this book resonated with a lot of people who have experienced this in the workplace, but it's a big enough problem where research is showing that it's becoming increasingly problematic in our generations, from generation to generation. Some work by Tom Curran out in the United Kingdom has suggested that perfectionism has been growing over the last 20 to 30 years.
And for reasons he suggests, I mean, does he suggest why?
There are suggestions. You know, I think that it's a self-perpetuating problem in general. People get praised for quality work. It's like when a supermodel gets praised for the way they look, they're going to keep trying to look that way. Mm-hmm. If a kid is getting A pluses on things and gets all the attention and praise, they're going to try to keep doing that. And so it's this sort of reinforcing model where they're going to keep doing it. And, you know, a lot of the problem is it's really ingrained in society quite a bit. There's this achievement culture.
Oh, absolutely.
That gets perpetuated. And I'm sure you've seen it in education. I see it in the workplace.
I mean, I remember as a kid sort of experiencing the felt sense that, like, you know, I didn't quite say it this way, but like everything is either a feather in your cap or a kick in the teeth.
Yeah, there's no middle ground, right?
Because nobody's letting you do anything without telling you where you distribute in the mass of distribution, right? Like, oh, you're on the 93rd percentile. Oh, you're in the 38th percentile. And it's that it almost seems it's in our sports. It shows up everywhere.
Yeah. And the worst thing that I think that we're doing right now is we're not teaching executive functioning skills like, you know, executive functioning is a suite of skills in your head, like planning organizing and decision-making, like the little, you know, chief executive officers.
Yeah,
in your
exactly.
Head.
The assistant that lives in your mind.
Exactly. And we don't teach kids how to use these skills and develop them. And so we have a really difficult time prioritizing. And so kids don't learn the critical thinking and executive functioning skills to prioritize their task effort. And so this is something I write about in chapter 5 of the book, Flawed, is not all tasks are meant to be done equally, right? So there's, I call it the emphasis framework. There's emphasis A, which is to do everything with 110%. Full gusto, give it your all. Then there's emphasis B, which is what I call the get her done strategy. Just get her done, right? And then there's the emphasis C strategy, which is to not do it at all. Just completely ignore it. And, you know, there's a time and place for all three of these. There's no inherent judgment. There is a time and place for emphasis A. Maybe I'm planning my wedding and it's super important to me and I want to make sure I give it my all. Emphasis B, honestly, is what I think should be most things in life. Not everything is written, things just aren't that important, right? And then emphasis C has plenty of good moments where it shines. Like I never answered the customer service satisfaction call at the end of my, you know, mobile carrier customer service call. I just don't, right? I hang it up because I've determined that it's not worth my time. And that's so important, right? So emphasis A, emphasis B, and emphasis C are strategic. They're used strategically and they're based on your values, what's important to you, right? And the problem with perfectionism is that perfectionists try to emphasis A everything.
Everything.
And because of that, it's totally impossible. Because of that, things get pushed off and they end up turning into emphasis C. So it's a forced emphasis C. Right. Things don't get done. They get pushed off. They're procrastinated. And then ultimately, so what does that mean? That means your perfectionism and your anxiety in that case are choosing your priorities and your behavior, not your values. And so what I try to do with people in the work setting and in my clinic here, where I treat people with severe perfectionism, is I work with them on this task prioritization based on their values. And essentially what it ends up meaning is that people are asked to plan or to emphasis B and C things that they think ought to be emphasis A. And it's a real anxiety provoking exercise for them.
Mm.
Right. So instead of spending 3 hours writing this email, you get to write it once, you get to read it a second, one other time, and then you send it off and you have 3 minutes to do this. Or I'd like you to send this email and I'd like you to make a mistake on purpose. And people look at me like I'm like a quack, but I say, look, just, you know, create a misspelling in your sign off. Instead of cordially, write quarterly, right? And let's see what happens. Let's see if it's as catastrophic as you think it is. and let's see if you can handle the anxiety, because a lot of the people think they can't. And so we do these kinds of exercises and we do it in a systematic way and we do it repeatedly and consensually, right? I would never do this to somebody. And over time, people start to loosen their thinking. They start to get a little bit more flexible. They start to think, oh, this is not as bad as I thought, or I can handle this, or look, the boss didn't even notice, or if they did notice, they didn't even care, right? And so making mistakes on purpose, who would have thought?
It's a very naive question, so I apologize, but how bad how bad can it get? And I don't mean with a group, but more an individual. You know, no names, and you don't, but if there's an example, like, you know, somebody walks in your door, they come for help. They're not, I'm assuming, somebody suggested, you know, you really have a problem with that. Or it gets to the point where it really becomes unlivable for them.
Yep. And so the book is not tailored to the extreme cases.
Because, no, I get that.
I keep
asking about the topic, and I know you want to go back to the book. And
No. I'm making that point for a reason. The reason that point is because most people with extreme perfectionism, they can't even survive in a job in the first place. So the book is meant for people that are not that extreme, because those extreme folks, you're not going to really see them a bunch in the workplace. Mm. And so you asked me this question, and the answer is they can get really, really clinically severe, to the point where people can't hold jobs, they can't get through school, they can't maintain relationships, they just become essentially paralyzed. They can't make decisions. They get stuck doing things for hours per day. They feel like they're just, you know, the worst people in the world, that because they're either perfect or they're not. And so if they're not, that means they're awful people. And so you get like tremendous depression and helplessness and anxiety and suicidality. Mm. And like, it can get extremely severe. And so I see them in my clinic. And this partly is what inspired me to write the book, is like, there's an approach to dealing with this, and it can help them. And if it can help them, it can also help the masses of people out in the workforce that struggle with this on a lesser level, but still struggling. And most importantly, it can help managers and leaders work with those people.
Do you ever get managers and leaders who are themselves perfectionists? And usually that would make them not particularly successful managers or leaders, right? Because they're putting on their teams, they're putting on the people that report to them, you know, conditions and requirements that nobody really wants to live under.
So it depends, right? Some people make it quite high and are quite successful with perfectionism, because it can have really good qualities that come with it. Things like conscientiousness and loyalty and honesty and attention to detail. There's a lot of good qualities that come with it. And also, there are certain types of jobs where perfectionism really can help you thrive to a certain degree. Right? Yes. If you're a computer programmer, for example, or a surgeon, it could probably be pretty helpful. Totally. But there does get to a point where I think there's a point of diminishing returns. And yes, lots of leaders have perfectionism, but you tend to find the best and most successful leaders tend not to have perfectionism. So you tend to see CEOs that are super successful. They tend not to be super perfectionistic, because you have to be able to be quick and nimble, and you have to make decisions on the fly. You have to be willing to take risk. You can't sit there and be indecisive.
Right. Right.
And you have to be willing to be accountable for mistakes. And so you tend to get the CEOs of a lot of companies, especially successful ones, tend not to be super perfectionistic. The people right below them, they are the ones that could be. So you have your...
The CEOs, at least the best ones that I've ever met, you know, that they have a knack for seeing in people what the best that person can be, and steer them in a way, and, you know, celebrate and encourage those things, which probably that person brings more of than anybody else in the place. And so if you can shape a set of expectations that really draws on that person's strengths, it's, you know, and those CEOs, you know, they're good at that. The good ones are really good at that.
Yeah, they could take a perfectionist, and assuming that they're not doing things to try to reduce the negative impact.
Yeah.
That would be this partly what my book is about, is like, how do you reduce the negative impact? But they probably do find just the right niche for them to succeed and to gain most value from their perfectionistic tendencies.
Yeah.
You know, the book is not about changing someone from to do a 180 from being a perfectionist to someone who's sloppy and terrible. It's about, how do you mitigate the damage that can come from perfectionism, and then preserve some of the good qualities that come with it as well.
And I know they're in there. I mean, I've read through them, some of them, but are those tasks easy to do? Right. I mean, you know, are there simple things that people can get a handle on either themselves because they suffer from it. Mm-hmm. Suffer may be the wrong word, but they recognize they're less in control than the perfectionism, or a manager can actually make suggestions that are useful for that perfectionist.
Yeah, there are and there are certain suggestions in the book that I would go back to, and one of them I just was discussing, I think, is a useful framework, the emphasis framework for communicating the importance of task prioritization and what's truly important based on your values. How's that important to the company and the company's values, or the school and the school's values, or the marriage and the marriage values? You know, there's, you can apply this anywhere. And the idea is, can you create a shared language and worldview around this idea that we really, you know, encourage quality work, but we also equally appreciate efficiency. And we are a safe place where if you make mistakes, like, and it was in the spirit of innovation and efficiency, you know, go get them, right? That's good. I was just thinking about a baseball analogy. I don't know if you're a baseball guy, but,
I was.
You were, right? So the idea is, like, if someone is trying to, if you're giving your baseball player a stolen base threat base runner, some leeway to steal third, especially if there's, you know, if it would make the first or the third out, which is a no-no in baseball, right? You never try to get out at third base because you can score easily from second on a base hit. But like sometimes that base runner is going to get out at third base trying to steal. You're going to misjudge. And the idea is, how do you approach that? Do you scold them and tell them like that's a no-no? You violated this, you know, sacred rule of baseball? Because by doing that, you're creating a psychologically unsafe environment where the person's not going to be willing to take risks anymore. Mm. And if that's what you're trying to encourage, great, go for it. But if you're encouraging someone to take risks, be innovative, run on their gut, like these kinds of things, you can't have it both ways. And so you have to be careful what environment you set up. And you want a psychologically safe one where someone feels like they can take that risk.
Well, and also, I mean, in some ways it circles back to that first question, where's the line, right? Because you want somebody, in the perfect world, you want somebody to be, you'll excuse the expression, perfectly discerning, right? I can make it to third, and they're right. As opposed to, oh no, too much of a risk. Sorry, so I'm staying on second. And if they could discern perfectly, they wouldn't be perfectionists. Yeah. They could easily see that line, right, and make the right decisions and then not punish themselves. And that's the kind of, I think that's the kind of environment, is you imagine what's a healthy work environment. It's an environment where this person wants me to be me, but a more discerning version of it. Right? I can make better decisions around this thing that he or she agrees with. Yeah.
Or maybe it's time to have a feedback session and be like, look, this is not your strong suit, right? Yeah. Like, it, you know, Frank Thomas shouldn't be stealing third base. I don't know. He's a big third baseman. Like, you don't need, or first baseman, you don't need to be stealing third base. Like, maybe this is a job for somebody else, right? And the idea is, I think discerning who needs to have the ability to, or who has the ability to discern, or can they even reach that level? And, you know, and that's kind of nuanced thinking is not something that a perfectionist tends to do very well. They're very all or none. They're very yes or no, black or white. And they tend to be very rule driven. And I talk about this in chapter 7, is that they tend to be overly focused on rules and sometimes at the expense of the underlying principle. Right. And so, for example, I use the example of, a sign near a pool. It's summertime, so let's think about pools for a second. And the pool says no running, right? It's a very important rule. I think we can all agree, unless you're a kid who doesn't want to not run at a pool. Right. But for the most part, adults can see the logic in not running near a pool. Well, that rule is based on a principle. That principle is that pools are dangerous because the ground gets wet and it's slippery and you can fall and crack your head open. The value underlying that principle is safety, public safety. Sure. And so you have this sort of pyramid scheme where you have this rule built on a principle, built on a value. And the problem with perfectionists is that they tend to overemphasize the rule at the top.
The rule.
Some, sometimes at the expense of the underlying principle driving that rule. And the example I give is if the lifeguard is whistling and yelling at a parent for running near the pool because they're trying to save a child drowning in the pool, right? There's an example of someone being super rigid about a rule and in a way that completely contradicts right. the underlying
Absolutely. Principle. Good example. Good example. Mm-hmm. As you were speaking, it's like, is there, you know, in your travels, is there, just say there's any sort of overlap between perfectionism, which feels like a sort of an obsession. We spoke about that a moment ago, but or a little while ago, but people on the spectrum. So often people on the spectrum are intensely focused on rules.
Yes. So people with autism on the autism spectrum have higher rates of perfectionism than
they have higher rates of perfectionism.
Yes. And they also tend to be much more rule bound and concrete in their thinking. And they tend to be very all or none in their thinking and very rigid in their thinking. So yes, we see a lot of perfectionism among people on the spectrum.
But
it's not surprising because we see perfectionism in general is not associated with a specific disorder. It's not a diagnosis, but it's a personality component, a personality feature. And it correlates very strongly with the obsessive compulsive disorder spectrum. And it correlates very strongly with the autism spectrum. And in, not surprisingly, the autism spectrum and the OCD spectrum, the obsessive compulsive spectrum, they are very highly correlated, both genetically and based on their presentation. Yeah. So the idea that perfectionism shows up in both is not a surprise. But it's not necessary. You don't see perfectionism in everyone with autism and you don't see perfectionism in everyone with OCD either.
Right. I see.
And you don't see, and people with perfectionism don't always have either of those. Like you can have just perfectionistic tendencies.
Right. Right. So a personal question. So do you have any insight into how you landed in this territory of, was it kind of, I was going to be humorous, but I don't know you well enough, but I was going to say with this obsession for perfectionism, I mean, like, why is this territory something that was a point of fascination or interest? Do you have any insight into that?
Yeah. My compulsive need to be an expert in OCD. Yeah, no, it's, I just became, I became fascinated with OCD in grad school. I also was, training to work in the autism spectrum and so I saw the overlap. I actually ended up switching more towards OCD because I just fell in love with it. And part of it is that OCD was fascinating to me, but also the treatments for it are just amazingly effective in general. And so it was really rewarding to provide a treatment that just absolutely was the gold standard for psychotherapy and cognitive behavior therapy. Mm-hmm. And but as a presentation, it was just really fascinating. In terms of my own experience, I don't have OCD, but I would say that I've experienced my own levels of perfectionism. And so I think part of my interest in OCD also resonated with me because of that and seeing some similarities in the OCD world and the perfectionism world. Mm. Now, my perfectionism wasn't nearly as extreme as some of the cases I talk about in my like from my clinic, but I think it gives me a little bit more of a personal understanding of what this perfectionism thing is all about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, you know, especially when you see it. I mean, I remember, I was thinking about this podcast today, and I remember one place I lived, I belonged to a gym, and I would show up as did, you know, all creatures of habit. We would all show up mostly the same people at the same early time. You know, we wanted to get our workout in early and whatever. And so I didn't necessarily know the people, but we knew each other. We all sort of knew each other, but not really. And this one guy, I watched him one day, and it's like I'd seen him every day. I went, and he went around. He was dressed in his gym clothes, brought his work clothes with him into the gym because he was obviously going off to work after that, and closed the car door, and then went around and checked every car door that it was locked. He clicked it, mm-hmm. and it locked. But he went around. And he must have gone around 4 or 5 times, every door, checking it 4 or 5 times, and pressing the, you know, each time, maybe three or four times. So it was almost like a ritual, right? But it wasn't clearly not. and then I realized he did it all the time, did it every day. Every day he showed up and that was his thing. And it was just, you know, in some ways it seemed benign, but you just don't know where else and how else that surfaces.
Well, yeah. And we call that a ritual in OCD. It is an OCD ritual. So I don't know if that's OCD because I wasn't there. I don't know what the purpose of the behavior was, but I would not be shocked by any stretch of the imagination if that were an OCD presentation. And the other thing I would say is if you're seeing that in the parking lot of the gym, most likely that's not the only time and place where that individual is struggling with that kind of a ritual.
Right.
So it's unclear. Well,
and I wonder, I mean, it's an easy assumption. It's like, that's a struggle. But is it a struggle? Or is it just, you know, or is it just, no, that's what I do. You know, I want to make sure that it's unlocked.
That's a great question. And that's what separates people with OCD from people without it is how much does it get in the way of your life?
Does it get in the way of your life?
How much does it cause you distress? How much does it affect the people around you?
Yeah.
And if you check off any of those boxes, it's probably OCD.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, so I have another question, maybe perhaps a final question, because I'm trying to be sensitive to your time. If I knew what I was talking about, what would I have asked you that you wish you could have answered? You wish you could have said that, but I didn't. We didn't get there.
I think the only thing that I didn't get a chance to answer that you had asked was, like, what do you do if the boss has perfectionist tendencies, right? And, you know,
hard to imagine, right?
But luckily, there's a fantastic book out there for that. It's called Flawed, Why Perfectionism is a Challenge for Management, by Dr. Greg Chasson. Specifically, chapter 10 is where I flip the script. So the rest of the book
you
is
do.
About how...
I didn't get there. I'm so sorry.
That's all right. Chapter 1 through 9 is all about how do you deal with perfectionism in your teams.
Yeah.
Chapter 10 flips it for people that want to know, how do you deal with a perfectionistic boss? And there are ways in there that I talk about how you might be able to recognize it. It shows how it sort of manifests a little differently. Like perfectionistic bosses can come across as a little bit stingy. They tend to ask for what's called a role reversal reassurance seeking question. Like, how, you know, like, am I a good boss? Was that a reasonable decision? Like questions that would suggest that they're seeking reassurance about whether they did a good job as a boss. And then there are some other things in there as well, but the idea and safety behaviors and rituals and avoidances. And then I give some strategies on how to set boundaries, assertiveness training, and then ultimately send the message along that sometimes you only have so much control in a work environment, that if your boss has perfectionism and is unwilling to respond to any of your gentle nudges, your only leverage is...
You got to go up the ladder somewhere.
Go up the ladder or find a different...
Or get out. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah. There's always that.
There's always that.
Yes. Well, Greg Chasson, I'm glad you're doing the job you're doing. It sounds both fascinating and I imagine it would, that book would resonate with lots of people, because I see it, I saw it, you know, I worked for a little bit of time, I worked within Snapchat, and not as a coder, but I worked with many coders, really. And watching how that showed up, well, you know, I'm clearly not a clinician and couldn't make it, but watching the frustration that came from sort of both versions of that. Sometimes it was the guy in charge, and sometimes it was the guy who was working on the team, and it was clearly there, and it's like, wow, this, and sometimes really got out of hand, which was kind of why I was there, not as a psychologist, but as a person who facilitated conversation between people who tend not to share how they feel about things. So,
like computer scientists and programmers? Yeah, exactly. They tend to be a little bit more internal bunch that don't like to speak. I've always thought perfectionism would be a great topic to come and discuss with corporations in Silicon Valley, because there's probably like perfectionists coming out of their ears.
I don't think our the technological world we now swim in, it would be 50 years behind if it wasn't for perfectionists in Silicon Valley. It's like,
right.
The whole place is filled with it.
Right, but I wonder how much more far along, how much farther we could be if there wasn't all the distress.
If there wasn't, right? Yes, that's true.
If they just used their talents instead and were flexible around it instead of.
Yeah. It's funny.
It's really interesting.
This is a story apropos of nothing. I'm sure I'll cut it out, but I was in undergraduate school, but I was toward the end of my time and I was, I'd finished all my course requirements, blah, blah, blah. And so I really liked math. I'd never taken a math theory class. I didn't even really understand what the hell that was. Mm-hmm. So I took one and it was fascinating, wonderful. I met at night. Mm-hmm. And one day this guy, the professor, whose name I won't remember, walked in with a friend of his, whose name I won't remember, who was the Nobel Prize winner.
Uh-huh.
And he just was talking to us, not about something in particular, I don't think, but just talking to us. And it's, it was back in the day where you could smoke in rooms.
Right.
And he's sitting there and he's sitting up at the front of the room. He's just sitting down and he's got a hot cup, a steaming hot cup of coffee and a cigarette. And he's talking and he's drinking his coffee and taking his big, and at a moment he kind of caught himself and he looked up, he looked at his cigarettes, if not for coffee and cigarettes, math would be 50 years behind where it is today. It's like, okay.
That's probably true for most industries.
That's probably right. Yeah. That's probably right. Well, yeah. Greg Chasson, Dr. Greg Chasson, Gregory Chasson, Dr. Gregory Chasson, or Greg.
Greg is fine, yes.
Thank you so much for being willing to come and talk about this book that is obviously caught on. I hope you're making lots of money selling it and doing workshops everywhere. It's clearly both interesting and important, suffer from it. So
thank you for this. And it sounds like I have a convert on my hands. At first you're like, is this really something you see in business? And now you're like, oh, this is.
Yeah. And it really started me thinking about some of the students that I've dealt with over the years and that inability. And again, as I said at the beginning, sometimes they were phenomenal students. The work they produced was crazy good. And sometimes we didn't even know if they were phenomenal students because they couldn't start. They couldn't start. And then other times they couldn't finish.
They get stuck, and I'm hoping that my book will help them get unstuck.
Yeah, well, absolutely. And certainly your work is doing that. And so I hope that book, and the book again is
Flawed.
Got paper. Flawed. Why Perfectionism is a Challenge for Management. And why Perfectionism is a Challenge, it says for management. But I would imagine, at least the parts that I've read, that it would offer insights to, don't just think of it as a business book. It will offer insights to people that work in groups.
Yeah, don't tell anyone. That's the secret of this book, is that it's actually not just for management. I've had people read it who are not even in business, and they found it to be perfectly applicable to what they're
doing in
teams, in schools, in marriages, and you name it, religious organizations. I picked an audience to write this to, and I think it works very well for managers and leaders. But if you're a perfectionist, I think you'll benefit. If you're living with a perfectionist, I think you'll benefit. If your parents are a perfectionist, I think you'll benefit. If your podcaster is a perfectionist, I think you'll benefit. I think there's a transcendent nature.
Totally. That part I got, indeed.
Yeah.
Anyway, thank you. Thank you so much. Really a pleasure.
Yeah, likewise. Thank you for having
me. And good luck with whatever's next.
You're listening to Curiosity Invited with David Bryant here on LA Talk Radio.